David, 990 BC, roughly, was more politic and successful than his predecessor, and he seems to have placed himself under the protection of Hiram, king of Tyre. This Phoenician alliance sustained him and was the essential element in the greatness of his son, Solomon. His story, with its constant assassinations and executions, reads rather like the history of some savage chief than of a civilized monarch. It's told with great vividness in the second book of Samuel. The first book of Kings begins with the reign of King Solomon, 960 BC, roughly. The most interesting thing in that story, from the point of view of the general historian, is the relationship of Solomon to the national religion and the priesthood, and his dealings with the tabernacle, the priest Zadok, and the prophet Nathan. The opening of Solomon's reign is as bloody as his father's. The last recorded speech of David arranges for the murder of Shimei. His last recorded word is blood. "But his hoarhead bring thou down to the grave with blood," he says, pointing out that though old Shimei is protected by a vow David had made to the Lord so long as David lives, there's nothing to bind Solomon in that matter. Solomon proceeds to murder his brother, who has sought the throne but quailed and made submission. He then deals freely with his brother's party. The weak hold of religion upon the racially and mentally confused Hebrews at that time is shown by the ease with which he replaces the hostile chief priest by his own adherent, Zadok, and still more strikingly by the murder of Joab by Benaiah, Solomon's chief ruffian in the tabernacle, while the victim is claiming sanctuary and holding to the very horns of Jehovah's altar. Then Solomon sets to work in what was, for that time, a thoroughly modern spirit, to recast the religion of his people. He continues the alliance with Hiram, king of Sidon, who uses Solomon's kingdom as a high road by which to reach and build shipping upon the Red Sea, and a hitherto unheard-of wealth accumulates in Jerusalem as a result of this partnership. Gang labor appears in Israel. Solomon sends relays of men to cut cedar wood in Lebanon under Hiram and organizes a service of porters through the land. There's much in all this to remind the reader of the relations of some Central African chief to a European trading concern. Solomon then builds a palace for himself and a temple not nearly as big for Jehovah. Hitherto, the Ark of the Covenant, the divine symbol of these ancient Hebrews, had abode in a large tent, which had been shifted from one high place to another, and sacrifices had been offered to the God of Israel upon a number of different high places. Now the ark is brought into the golden splendors of the inner chamber of a temple of cedar-sheathed stone, and put between two great winged figures of gilded olive wood, and sacrifices are henceforth to be made only upon the altar before it. This centralizing innovation will remind the reader of both Akhenaton and Nabonidus. Such things as this are done successfully only when the prestige and tradition and learning of the priestly order has sunken to a very low level. And he appointed, according to the order of David his father, the courses of the priests to their service, and the Levites to their charges, to praise and minister before the priests as the duty of every day required. The porters also by their courses at every gate, and so had David, the man of God, commanded. And they departed not from the commandment of the king unto the priest and Levites concerning any matter or concerning the treasures. Neither Solomon's establishment of the worship of Jehovah in Jerusalem upon this new footing, nor his vision of and conversation with his God at the opening of his reign stood in the way of his developing a sort of theological flirtatiousness in his declining years. He married widely, if only for reasons of state and splendor, and he entertained his numerous wives by sacrificing to their national deities, to the Sidonian goddess Ashtaroth Ishtar, to Chemosh, a Moabitish god, to Moloch, and so forth. The Bible account of Solomon does in fact show us a king and a confused people, both superstitious and mentally unstable, in no way more religious than any other people of the surrounding world. a point of considerable interest in the story of Solomon because it marks a phase in Egyptian affairs, is his marriage to a daughter of Pharaoh. This must have been one of the pharaohs of the 21st dynasty. In the great days of Amenophis III, as the Telamana letters witness, Pharaoh could condescend to receive a Babylonian princess into his harem, but he refused absolutely to grant so divine a creature as an Egyptian princess in marriage to the Babylonian monarch. It points to the steady decline of Egyptian prestige that now, 3 centuries later, such a petty monarch as Solomon could wed on equal terms with an Egyptian princess. There was, however, a revival with the next Egyptian dynasty, the 22nd, and the pharaoh Shishak, the founder, taking advantage of the cleavage between Israel and Judah, which had been developing through the reigns of both David and Solomon, took Jerusalem and looted the all-too-brief splendours both of the new temple and of the king's house. Shishak seems also to have subjugated Philistia. From this time onward, it's to be noted that the Philistines fade in importance. They had already lost their Cretan language and adopted that of the Semites they had conquered, and although their cities remain more or less independent, they merge gradually into the general Semitic life of Palestine. There's evidence that the original rude but convincing narrative of Solomon's rule, of his various murders, of his association with Hiram, of his palace and temple building, and the extravagances that weakened and finally tore his kingdom in twain, has been subjected to extensive interpolations and expansions by a later writer, anxious to exaggerate his prosperity and glorify his wisdom. It isn't the place here to deal with the criticism of Bible origins, but it's a matter of ordinary common sense, rather than of scholarship, to note the manifest reality and veracity of the main substance of the account of David and Solomon, an account explaining sometimes and justifying sometimes, but nevertheless relating facts, even the harshest facts, as only a contemporary or almost contemporary writer convinced that they can't be concealed would relate them, and then to remark the sudden lapse into adulation when the inserted passages occur. It's a striking tribute to the power of the written assertion over realities in men's minds that this Bible narrative has imposed not only upon the Christian but upon the Muslim world the belief that King Solomon wasn't only one of the most magnificent, but one of the wisest of men. Yet the first book of Kings tells in detail his utmost splendours, and beside the beauty and wonder of the buildings and organisations of such great monarchs as Thothmes III, or Ramses II, or half a dozen other pharaohs, or of Sargon II, or Sardanapalus, or Nebuchadnezzar the Great, they're trivial. His temple, measured internally, was 20 cubits broad, about 35 feet. That's the breadth of a small villa residence, and 60 cubits, say 100 feet long. And as for his wisdom and statescraft, one need go no further than the Bible to see that Solomon was a mere helper in the wide-reaching schemes of the traitor king Hiram, and his kingdom a pawn between Phoenicia and Egypt. His importance was due largely to the temporary enfeeblement of Egypt, which encouraged the ambition of the Phoenician and made it necessary to propitiate the holder of the key to an alternate trade route to the east. To his own people, Solomon was a wasteful and oppressive monarch, and already before his death his kingdom was splitting visibly to all men. With the reign of King Solomon, the brief glory of the Hebrews ends. The northern and richer section of his kingdom, long oppressed by taxation to sustain his splendours, breaks off from Jerusalem to become the separate kingdom of Israel, and this split ruptures that linking connection between Sidon and the Red Sea by which Solomon's gleam of wealth was possible. There's no more wealth in Hebrew history. Jerusalem remains the capital of one tribe, the tribe of Judah, the capital of a land of barren hills, cut off by Philistia from the sea, and surrounded by enemies. The tale of wars, of religious conflicts, of usurpations, assassinations, and of fratricidal murders to secure the throne goes on for 3 centuries. It's a tale, frankly, barbaric. Israel wars with Judah and the neighboring states, forms alliances first with one and then with the other. The power of Aramean Syria burns like a baleful star over the affairs of the Hebrews, and then there rises behind it the great and growing power of the last Assyrian empire. For 3 centuries, the life of the Hebrews was like the life of a man who insists upon living in the middle of a busy thoroughfare, and is consequently being run over constantly by omnibuses and motor lorries.